Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Christian civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and, well, this evening our guest is Mr. Edward Erickson. Actually, he's a professor, he's a scholar. He's written a fascinating book with another gentleman on the Solzhenitsyn Reader. It gets into really many of the articles, the poems, and even summaries of some of the books that Solzhenitsyn has written that have never been translated into English. And you'll have an opportunity to read what most Americans, what many Americans, have never had an opportunity to read, and that is some of the books written by Solzhenitsyn, at least summaries of them, that are not readily available here just because they've never been translated before into English. Professor Erickson, thank you so very much for being with us.
Well, I'm glad to be with you again.
Well, so why don't you give our listeners out there just a little bit of the background so they'll know who you are and why it is that you've put together a book on Solzhenitsyn and why this book is so different and why it's so important.
Well, I'm an English teacher, not a Russian specialist, but when I was a young professor, I was captivated by the writings of Alexander Solzhenitsyn. And my general early reaction, slightly overstated, is people were telling the truth in what they said about him and the whole truth and nothing but the truth, but they weren't telling the whole truth. Well, later it became clear that they were also not always telling nothing but the truth. What I meant was, here is a man who writes out of a profound moral vision, but that moral vision has to come from somewhere, from a larger worldview that takes into account all the reality of the universe and the reality of human nature. And I, as a Christian, intuited that he must be a Christian, though he'd never at that point publicly identified himself as such. My way of saying it is, either he was a Christian or he might as well be a Christian. And so I began explaining him to fellow Christians who read magazines that I wrote for, and on the organizing principle of my life, namely that one thing leads to another, the articles turned to a book and then to books, and then I, at Solzhenitsyn, fell from being a celebrity figure to a sideline figure. I had a passion for helping to make his work known to people who didn't know it. And so I engaged in what I might call midwifing his works to English language readers. And my great enterprise in that direction was to abridge his historically very important work, The Gulag Archipelago, because it's so long and so involved with Russian history, which his primary audience of Russian readers needs, that Western readers were missing the opportunity to see the universal moral lessons available in his writing. And I'm happy to say that abridgment stays in print indefinitely now, placed in a line called Perennial Classics. Do you need to take a break?
No, well, we're going to in just a moment here. Don't you worry, I'll interrupt you.
Okay. I thought I heard some music.
You do. Go ahead.
Just to finish, recently a colleague and I put together the book that you referred to, The Solzhenitsyn Reader. Selections, very generous, copious selections of his writings with some commentary by us, and that's where we are today with
that
book out.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest is a professor, Edward Erickson, and we're talking about the Solzhenitsyn Reader. And, of course, You have to, if you write, you're going to have to write from some worldview. Either there is a God or there isn't a God. There's really only two options there. And, of course, I think that Solzhenitsyn really started out, you know, as an atheist. He started out as a communist. He was fully in support of this idea, this utopian idea that man can create a perfect world. And then, well, I'm going to let you tell the story of the metamorphosis of Solzhenitsyn's view and how he came to the conclusions he did.
Yes, you have stated the beginning point. That is to say, after a childhood rearing in the ways of the church, he went to Soviet schools, and whatever he was taught as a young boy was quickly driven out of him by his Soviet teachers, and he became a dedicated, convinced Marxist-Leninist. He identified himself proudly as a communist. That didn't keep him from seeing certain problems in the Soviet Union, and when he was in the Red Army, he and a friend exchanged private letters in which they were critical of certain strategic moves by Stalin, the top leader. And those letters were intercepted and read by military censors, and four private correspondents with criticisms milder by far than what we see regularly in our open press of our commander-in-chief, Solzhenitsyn was put in prison and spent 8 years in the prisons to which he gave the now world-identified name, the Gulag Archipelago, the whole chain of prison camps dotting the landscape of the Soviet Union. And in those prison camps, he met many sterling characters, none more impressive than the overrepresented religious believers. And gradually they're witnessed by their lives, and sometimes by their words, worked upon his heart until he turned his back on communism and embraced the faith of his forefathers. And from then on was a loyal Christian. He became an openly identified member of the Russian Orthodox Church, which is still the case for him. He just passed his 88th birthday, and he's still writing.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment with our... Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Professor Erickson, and we simply went through Solzhenitsyn's, you know, childhood, raised in a Christian faith, in the Russian Orthodox faith, and then or Eastern Orthodox faith, and then, of course, going to Soviet schools and becoming a dedicated communist, and then, you know, even as a dedicated communist, entering the military, but writing a letter, a series of letters, with some criticism of some of the things Stalin had done, which of course got him an 8-year sentence in the Gulag, in the Russian prison camps, put him into a situation where he was told that even when he got out of prison, he would never be allowed again to go back and live where his wife was. In other words, he would never be able to return to his home. And out of just this horrible change in his life, coming in contact with Christians, he returns to the faith of his childhood. And he then begins to write, but he does this very surreptitiously. He's afraid to write openly because, of course, he might be identified, and this would be used against him again. So you pick the story up from there, Professor.
Yes, in fact, the writing, well, he had as a boy begun writing, so it was an aspiration of his from childhood to be a writer. But writing in earnest began while he was in prison, and he composed long works in his head and memorized them. We have the wonder, and in fact, he did it much in poetry because poetry is easier to memorize than prose. And he tells us the wonderful story of his seeing some Catholics with rosary beads, and he says that which they made from pieces of bread that hardened. And he asked if they could make him a rosary necklace where According to his particular religion, so he told them, every 10th bead had to be square and every 50th bead had to be triangular. And he didn't explain any more about this, but they did it for their fellow prisoner. And this was his way of trying to help himself keep his poems straight in his head. When he got to the 10th line, if he was short of or past the square bead, he knew that something was wrong, and he had to go back and work on with his memory to get all the lines right. The poem that he composed that way ran to 7,000 lines. When he was first sent out of prison into that perpetual exile, away from his home and his wife, where he was a school teacher, then, in every spare moment, he wrote down what he had composed in his head. And he hid the manuscripts, a very tiny script, in a big bottle and buried the bottle in his backyard out in the desert of Kazakhstan. And that's the beginning of his writing. And then, as you say, after that he was still writing surreptitiously. We have a chapter of his memoirs called The Oak and the Calf. And the chapter in our Solzhenitsyn Reader, and the chapter is entitled The Writer Underground. And he tells much of the story of his composing of literature after he was finally allowed to come back to Russia proper and out of Kazakhstan. Quite an interesting chapter. The kind of thing that's available in profusion in the Reader. Fascinating stuff.
Well, of course, the thing was that it was very difficult to get anything published in Russia without without permission from the literary department of the Communist Party.
And it was impossible. That was the only way to be published.
And so what was it that he actually submitted for publication?
Well, let me back up. Khrushchev, after he became premier, in an attempt to establish his own niche in Soviet history, brought up the issue of Stalin's excesses. This was recognized by everyone, and so he could seem like a kind of slightly liberal reformer, loosening the shackles. And there came into being the cultural period or phenomenon called the Thaw. Well, it was an on-again, off-again thing, and you were never sure what might get through and what might not, so it was very risky to submit anything for publication if it might be perceived by the censors as anti-Soviet somehow. But he took the big risk and took a short novel, which we know by the title One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, and through intermediaries, he got it to Twardovsky, Alexander Twardovsky, the editor of the most famous literary magazine in the Soviet Union, who took it to his personal friend Nikita Khrushchev, and eventually, the story there continues to be fascinating, eventually Khrushchev authorized the publication of that novel. It was an enormous success.
But I think it's why did Khrushchev authorize it? Because it was almost as if it were almost as an act of God that this novel, which was critical of the Gulag situation, you know, and the lot of the prisoner, why did Khrushchev authorize it?
Well, Twardovsky said to his friend Khrushchev, look, this is critical of Stalinist excesses, and you can use it in your de-Stalinization campaign. It was, of course, critical of Stalin's excesses, but Stalin's excesses were the excesses of the regime itself. It was not only anti-Stalinist, it was anti-Soviet. And, more importantly and more broadly, it was simply anti-dehumanization of any sort. In other words, it has universal appeal and impact.
And, of course, Khrushchev actually wanted to use this to find out who supported him and who didn't. And so
I learned
from your book that he would give this to the people that he came in contact with, asking if they agreed with it or not.
Well, to the Politburo, to the inner circle of leaders. And he gave each a copy. and said, here, take this home and read it, and at our next meeting, advise me, each of you, one by one, should I publish it, allow it to be published or not. And when they came back, some said, yes, you should publish it. You can use it in your de-Stalinization campaign. And others said, no, you shouldn't allow it to be published because it's anti-Soviet more generally. At which point, as it were anyhow, Khrushchev shook his stubby finger at them and said, ah, so you are not with me in my de-Stalinization campaign. And so the very first use of this book, before it was published, was a political misuse to separate the sheep from the goats, Khrushchev style. And the great bane of Solzhenitsyn's literary reception ever since has been, and that's in the East as well as in the West, has been that he's been approached through the political prism. He's been seen as writing about politics. Well, if you write about public reality of human experience, you can hardly leave out politics. But politics is not central as a theme in Solzhenitsyn's work. Moral matters are central, or I might say fundamental, foundational.
Okay.
And that has been the great bane of Solzhenitsyn's reception, even among Western critics.
But the reason that the Western critics don't like Solzhenitsyn is because, you know, he objected to the excesses of communism. He objected to the very destruction of the individual by communism, the lack of a moral foundation, because he was coming from a Christian worldview, and the average intellectual isn't, and certainly both in Russia and even here in the United States. The intellectuals hated Solzhenitsyn, especially what he dared to mention, the millions and millions and millions of people who were killed, you know, by Stalin and by the system. In fact, when Solzhenitsyn wrote an article that was published in Foreign Affairs magazine, I remember very well, and he talked about the 60 million people who had been executed under Stalin, under communism. He was viciously attacked by intellectual leaders from all parts of the United States for daring to be so critical of communism. Look at all the good it had done. Was there justification?
Yes, just a few comments. That you have the story clear, definitely. That's how it was. The number 60 or 66 million, he borrows from a Russian emigre demographer, and it may well be too high. And we certainly are not talking about only those who were killed in the Gulag camps. This would include all those who were done to death at the initiative of the government, including, for example, enforced intentional famines in huge swatches of the countryside as collectivization was imposed. Let us say that the number is half that. Let us say that the number is 30 million. That still makes it, in quantitative terms, the greatest horror story in human history, unless sometime we learn of a higher number coming out of communist China. At any rate, it far exceeds the number of those killed by Hitler's Nazi Germany. And yet the story of the Holocaust is very well known. Students know the word Holocaust, know what it refers to. Students these days, very few, know the word Gulag and what it refers to. I know this from personal experience. I'm glad that we have Holocaust there as this great emblem of modern man's inhumanity to man. But there's another story every bit as worth knowing.
And that, of course, was really why Solzhenitsyn was really, of course, criticized, because he brought out the excesses of communism, and so many of our intellectuals seem to embrace this. A few people killed, but look at all the good it did. And they somehow were able to turn their back on the suffering and the horror and the torture and all of those things, as they seem to be thinking of a greater good. But, of course, that greater good ignores the sovereignty of God and are certainly of subservience to him. We'll be back in just a moment.
Okay.
Well, go right ahead there.
Well, Let me return to why Western critics were turned hostile to Solzhenitsyn. Initially, they were not, because they saw him as a freedom fighter, and they fancied themselves as freedom fighters. They were not. They considered themselves. I'm speaking in broad generalities here. Intellectuals, journalists, the chattering classes, as they're sometimes called. When Solzhenitsyn came on the scene and then was exiled to the West in 1974, they were anti-totalitarian, but the dominant intellectual mood of the United States is secular rather than religious. The elites were and are much more secular than average American citizens. And here comes the man who says the great underlying problem of the 20th century and why all these evils have befallen us is that men have forgotten God. Well, that's talking a language that intellectuals do not like. And in 1974, the most common refrain in criticism of Solzhenitsyn, and I kid you not, I do not make this up, was, why, he is not a liberal. As if any right-thinking person had to be a liberal, and if one was not a liberal, then there was something dangerous, perhaps reactionary, perhaps medieval about such a person. I give you now exact quotes. He is not the liberal we would like him to be. That's an exact quote. Very close to an exact quote is this one. I don't know exactly what Solzhenitsyn is, but whatever he is not a liberal. As if that's to say something helpful and penetrating about a person. And as if only liberals could be voices in favor of freedom. And so he was seen as a kind of nationalist. He was seen as, oh, there are crazy things said about him. The list of adjectives includes theocratic, messianic, monarchist, even, alas, anti-Semitic, for a charge for which there is no evidence, but the charge has taken on a life of its own. And strange cases are sort of spun out of thin air. His wife, in fact, is half Jewish, for whatever that may be worth in her nationality. And more than anything else, what that charge, he is not a liberal, shows is that what matters to our intellectual elites is politics, not the matters that he cares about. Even about the great Gulag Archipelago, you would think if any work has exposed the system of Soviet communism to be a sham and a facade, that's the work. And yet he says fairly early on, page 186, volume 1, so let anyone who thinks this is going to be a political expose slam its covers shut right now.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Professor Edward Erickson. We're talking about this Solzhenitsyn Reader. It's a brand new book, fascinating information in it, and we'll tell you later how to get it. You can get it from Amazon.com, and it should be available in bookstores. But Professor Erickson is simply pointing out that the reason that the liberals here in America didn't like Solzhenitsyn is because he didn't believe, you know, in their view of government to providing the what was going on, that Solzhenitsyn was not the type of liberal that they are, which is, of course, a political liberal. Solzhenitsyn believed in freedom, but he believed in God. And Solzhenitsyn believed that the problem of society, of Russian society, and the reason that Russian society degenerated into communism is because the people had forgotten God. And, of course, that is just an anathema to the liberal here in America who denies the existence of God, who thinks that anybody who believes in God is somehow sort of an inferior individual, who isn't as educated as they are. Well, I know Professor Erickson is well-educated, and I was well-educated as well. And I think that I learned, it took me many years to unlearn what I learned at the University of California, and to return to the faith of my youth. And I think this is what happens to so many people. The trouble is that they never get out to see the real world. They never have an opportunity to know what the world is about, and they never unlearn all of the bad things they've learned in college. I always like to say they're educated far beyond their intelligence. And they're a lot smarter in many ways than I am. And yet, of course, the simple fact that there is a God, I think, is the most important thing. And I know an awful lot of fellows who drive truck or do manual labor, who I think are a lot smarter than many of our university professors when it comes to really understanding what the world's about.
And Solzhenitsyn has a great fondness for what we might call the ordinary man, the we could say the regular Joe. He shares your sensibility. And by the way, your own experience from boyhood through university and then beyond is quite parallel to his own. Different countries, different details, but that same kind of trajectory through life. You know, I was saying that he told people in the Gulag, if you expect this to be a political expose, slam its covers shut right now. Immediately following that comes one of the most important passages in Solzhenitsyn, though it's a point he repeats elsewhere. He says, the line dividing good and evil cuts through, and when I'm teaching to college students, I always taught at a Christian college, I would pause there and say, how would you finish that sentence? I don't show them where I'm reading from. And inevitably, those with Christian backgrounds see the point. They get the answer essentially right. They say, well, we all have good and evil in us. It cuts right through our hearts. That's exactly what he says. It cuts through the heart of every human being. The line does not run between groups of people, good on one side, bad on the other, a good group, a bad group. No, we all carry both good and evil within us. Good because we're created in the image of God, bad because we're heirs of the original sin. And it was seeing a passage like that and many others of in that vein that caused me to think, well, actually, that passage hadn't gotten into English yet, but there were other passages that caused me to think, this man's either Christian or might as well be. You could see the same attitude toward human beings in the way he handled characters in his fiction. And then even as for politics, the standard secular view is these days is that democracy depends on a secular vision and religion is a threat to open, free society that is democratic. But in his famous Harvard address, he points out that in early America, people practiced democracy based on their commonality as creatures of God. And this was something that God built into the universe, that we were free. And that our democracy originally was not based on any secular notion abstracted from a belief in God. And he has always been more sympathetic to early America than to current America.
Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. And, of course, I think Solzhenitsyn recognized that.
That's it. That's a good verse to bring in.
Well, anyway, we'll be back here in just a moment. Our guest this evening is Professor Edward Erickson. We're talking about a fascinating book written about a fascinating man, Alexander Solzhenitsyn. And we'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and Professor Erickson, you picked the story up there.
Since you referred to the book, may I put in a bit of a plug, though it's nothing that that brings me remuneration. This past weekend, the book launch for the Solzhenitsyn Reader, which had been taped in Philadelphia in early November, played on C-SPAN, specifically on C-SPAN 2. People who are really interested in the subject, and this would not be as wide an audience as possibly would be interested in the book itself, can view the almost hour-long program. It's available for purchase over cspan.org on the web, on the internet. It's quite a nice show, and of the four speakers, we two co-editors are among the number. The other two are sons of Solzhenitsyn, two of the three sons, Ignat and Stefan, who were our major, not our sole, but our major translators for the quarter-plus book, part of the book that had never before been translated into English. And so people who are interested in Solzhenitsyn have that opportunity to see his sons, listen to them speak. And they're just wonderful young men.
Well, of course, they were really raised here in the United States, weren't they?
Yes, they were. They rode yellow school buses to American public schools near Cavendish, Vermont, which is where they lived.
And of course, the thing is that Solzhenitsyn was here, what, for 20, 25 years?
Something? No, he was in the United States for 18 years right. of the total of 20 in Western exile. It's hard for me to imagine this. But he has been back home in Russia 12 and a half years now, more than half of his total exile in the West. That exile seemed long, and his time back home seems short to me, but that's just an indication that I'm aging. And time flies.
Well, I think we all are.
Yep, we are.
He was a remarkable individual. But, of course, everything he wrote, really, was based upon his worldview.
Yes, that's right.
And his worldview was that there was a God. If you try to write, you know, and try to explain what life is about, or what takes place in the world, and you're writing from a secular point of view, you got real problems, because, believe me, it's pretty hard to make any sense out of anything that goes on in the world today without realizing that there is a God, and that God, of course, rules in the affairs of men. And we'll be back here in just a moment with Professor Erickson. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Edward Erickson, Professor Edward Erickson. We're talking about the book Solzhenitsyn Reader. Professor Erickson was saying that if you're interested in seeing a discussion of the book, and of course, you get the book at Amazon.com, but if you would like to see the C-SPAN, they put a program on C-SPAN 2 a week or two ago, and you'll see Professor Erickson. You'll have to get it from C-SPAN, Ed Erickson, his co-author, and then two of Solzhenitsyn's sons talking about Solzhenitsyn and his life's work, and it's available at C-SPAN if you're interested in getting that. We do have a caller, but I'm not going to put him on because I don't want to detract from our discussion, so you just go ahead and pick up the story. I think one of the interesting things is that Solzhenitsyn wrote a book about the Russians and the Jews. You know the exact title. It's never been
200 years together.
Right, and it's never been translated into English. And of course, there were problems in Russia, and there were the pogroms, and there was a great deal of hostility between the two groups. And yet, Solzhenitsyn addresses this, and of course, he's been lambasted for addressing it. But I think it had to be addressed. Would you like to pick the story up? Because you've actually reproduced the important parts of the book.
Yes, that's right. For the first time, some parts are now available in English in the Solzhenitsyn Reader, which is the book we're talking about. There's much more. It's an extensive study of what I think we should just fairly call historical scholarship. And he writes this because the relations between Russians and Jews are sensitive and have been for two centuries, and it's a difficult subject. It's a entrench themselves in taking sides. And he tries to transcend that side-taking approach, the us-against-them approach, and to write a book that seeks to move the two nationalities toward reconciliation, toward acceptance of one another, toward better ways of living together than have been practiced in Russia for the two centuries from about 1792 to 1992. He talks about all the historical stages along the way. He talks, for example, about one of the great cruxes being, and that would be the revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 itself. It has been pointed out by some Russian partisan types that Jews were heavily represented among the Bolshevik revolutionaries, as if to say, the Jews gave us the revolution. Solzhenitsyn seeks to address that head-on, and he denies it flatly, though, this is very sad, you will see commentators, without quoting passages, say, that is Solzhenitsyn's view. He addresses the matter to deny that view. And he says that the revolutionaries who were Russian were not faithful to the spirit of Russia, and the revolutionaries who were Jewish were not faithful to the spirit of Judaism. Both of the long historical lines had their essence denied and deformed by these rebels within each group. And that's where we get this unholy alliance of some Russians and some Jews in the Bolshevik Revolution. Well, that's just one example of the care he seeks to take in being even-handed, in dispensing criticism and seeking to move beyond the criticisms toward reconciliation, as I said. He wishes that somebody else had done this book, that he wouldn't have to take that burden on, but it was so important that he thought somebody should do it. And he wrote it out of the same spirit of obligation that caused him to write the Gulag Archipelago itself. Somebody should tell the truth about the concentration camps of the Soviet Union. Nobody's doing it. He tried to enlist collaborators with him in the work. None of that worked out, though many people were willing to tell him their stories. He took down their stories and brought them into his single-author account of the Gulag Archipelago. There's a great deal of what he writes, which it seems to him his times have dictated that he write about. And so it was a very strong sense of duty and responsibility on his part, which I must say I find highly laudable.
And of course, he's truly a Russian patriot. He could have continued living in the United States in Vermont, where he had apparently a very large spread of land, and he had a chapel built there.
Yes, he did.
And, you know, very comfortable, but he chose to go back to Russia because he wanted, of course, to be there to perhaps help guide Russia through their transformation from communism to freedom. Unfortunately, communism, or at least authoritarianism, seems to be making a comeback. Do you have any idea how he feels about what's going on in Russia today?
Well, yes, I'm glad you said patriot. That's what he calls himself. And he emphasizes that patriots are not uncritical toward their country in the way we sometimes say, my country, right or wrong. He says that's not the mark of a real patriot. When our country is wrong, we should seek to correct its wrongs, and we should acknowledge our national transgressions. But when he speaks as a Russian patriot, and he admires any patriots, Americans who are American patriots, British who are British patriots, and so forth. He's Russian, and so he's a Russian patriot. What he resents is being called a nationalist. And sure enough, that's been the usual thing. said. But the point of nationalism would be to say, my country's better than yours. And that's what he denies even about the country that he loves. What he does say about recent times is that since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, Russia has been coming out from under the rubble of communism in the worst possible way. One example of that is that when the assets owned by the state were sold off, they were sold to an in-group of people who had enough money to band together to buy industries at fire sale prices, and they developed this whole cadre of nouveau riche, or new rich, which he labeled the oligarchs. That term is used widely now, the oligarchy in Russia, but no one seems to remember that Solzhenitsyn, or maybe know, that Solzhenitsyn is the one who applied the title first. So, after a terrible time in the 90s, which he categorizes and classifies and presents in a work called Russia in Collapse, maybe the most pessimistic work that this innately optimistic man wrote. I know he's not seen that way, but if you know him, you know that's the case. He's innately optimistic and hopeful. But Russia in Collapse is quite pessimistic. He catalogs the criticisms that he picked up traveling around Russia, and then he delivered those criticisms to the leaders in Moscow, where mostly his pleas on behalf of ordinary citizens fell on deaf ears. He does take more hope than I think most Western commentators do right now, that there is coming enough stability in the society. It could open the door to authoritarianism, but he would say, we don't have democracy, but we are getting the kind of stability that could cultivate democracy. That if anything, his old hopeful self is showing itself, is surfacing again, and we have the situation today, and it's not a terribly unusual one, that that our intellectuals are more pessimistic than he is about Russia, just as our intellectuals are more pessimistic than ordinary citizens are about the condition of the United States. Solzhenitsyn, once when he was in the United States, traveling through the heartland as he drove to California to do research at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, said, even I, when I get out into the heartland of America, can be lulled into a certain kind of complacency. Things are so good and solid and stable there. That's the sort of good feeling that I'm referring to.
Well, certainly, of course, Solzhenitsyn really, I think it's sort of captured the very feeling of almost hopelessness that the that many of the people in Russia had during the time of the Great Depression, the time of the Gulag, where everybody really lived in fear. And because, of course, the whole idea was to terrorize the people, and even after, you know, his only crime was he'd been critical of Stalin. And suddenly taken away from his family, and he never actually remarried his wife. He actually told her to get divorced, didn't he, so that she could have a life, because he realized he might never see her again?
Yes. Oh, the private lives of people were devastated by the actions of the state, and his life and his first wife's life, that's a classic example of that sort of devastation. But you know, after all of the hopelessness of people living with their heads down through the whole Soviet period, which after all runs for three generations, then comes what seems like the great breakthrough, and the whole system collapses, and there is a new kind of freedom. And this new freedom is so badly used by people with power and money, that ordinary citizens lapse back into a desperation deeper than they felt before. That's what underlies hit network Russia in Collapse, another one which appears in selections in our reader for the first time in English.
And I think it's so important that the Americans understand. I mean, they're out from underneath communism, and then of course was he influenced in that Russian collapse by the collapse of their currency, because this happened in the early 90s, in part because of course the advice that came from Harvard University.
That's right.
And of course here these Russians, people are, you know, scraping together the money they could save, you know, depending upon that for their old age, and suddenly, within a matter of just a few months, everything that these people had worked and struggled for, the money that they'd saved, was completely destroyed. That must have been a totally devastating, impact on the Russian people, having suffered so much. And then, when suddenly they're free, why, their monetary security is gone.
Yes, the pensioners lost all their pensions. Medical service, which in the old system had been provided by the state, was now unavailable unless you had money, which of course they didn't anymore. And yes, it was a terrible time, and it should have been a good time. That's what he means, that we were coming. It's an example of what he means when he says that we came out from under the rubble of communism in the worst possible way. There's an inspiring story in the midst of all this having to do with Solzhenitsyn. His work, The Gulag Archipelago, has been a huge, huge bestseller. Not everybody read what they bought, but volume one of the three volumes of The Gulag sold 3 million copies in the United States. 3 million. That's just unheard of. And volume two sold less and fewer, and volume three fewer yet. But worldwide, in a figure that comes from more than a decade, maybe two decades ago, already 35 million copies of that book had been sold. And Solzhenitsyn takes not one penny, or let's say kopeck, for himself out of all those royalties that have accrued. Instead, he established a Russian Social Fund, that's the name of it, and the proceeds of his royalties are dispensed through that fund to prisoners and families of prisoners in the Gulag, so that there are some thousands, I've forgotten the number, but some thousands of, few thousands of people in post-Soviet Russia, who have their basic financial needs met from the royalties of the Gulag Archipelago. He refers to himself, of course, as a member of the Russian nation. But after he was a Zek, the Russian slang for prisoner, and developed this great sense of solidarity with other Zeks in the Gulag, he came to consider himself a member of the Zek nation. And in fact, that's why when in 1994 he did return home to Russia, as he had confidently predicted for all 20 years of his exile that he would, he entered, as it were, through the back door. He flew from Alaska to the eastern coast of Russia, the Pacific coast, and immediately went to Magadan, the capital of the region, Kolyma, which is where the most brutal of all the Gulag camps were located, and it was as if he was paying homage to the Zek nation first as he came back to the motherland of Russia. And it was from there that he then, after going down to Vladivostok, took a 55-day train trip across Russia. This is where he began meeting normal Russian citizens, taking notes on what they said. And those notes went into that work I've mentioned a couple of times now, Russia in Collapse. It just happens I've mentioned it. It's not more important than other works, but it's part of a very interesting story about him.
And, of course, I think the thing is that a lot of his writings, most Americans have never heard of, because many of them have not been translated into English. And I think that's really one of the advantages of your production, is that even though you can't have all of them in their completeness, you've given most of them, in at least in part, to whet the appetite of the Americans.
Yes, that's
a fair statement? Well, you hold on there. We'll be back in just a moment. Our guest has been Edward Erickson. The book, Solzhenitsyn, Reader, available at Amazon.com. An excellent, excellent read. Well, Professor, do you have any sort of a website or anything you'd like to get out for our listeners?
No, not my own, but I would like to mention, and I should have thought of this earlier when I mentioned the C-SPAN site. Our publisher, ISI Books, has a website, and the book can be ordered, as you say, through Amazon. It can also be ordered through the ISI site, which is very simple. After the three W's, it's just ISI.org. Can hardly be shorter. But if you want to add a / and then books, immediately our book, the picture of the cover, will come up. And here's the reason I should have mentioned it earlier. A somewhat technically inferior version of our program of the book launch in Philadelphia in November is available on that site. The color isn't as good, and the shot from across this very large hall includes the backs of heads of people who were standing. The audience stood for an hour while we talked. And so you have people moving from one leg to another. And in short, you have bobbing bald spots showing in front of us. But all the speeches are there and can be heard without buying a tape from C-SPAN. Buying a tape will give you a much nicer experience, but the other at ISI.org is free.
All right, fine. Well, I think that it's important that the American people really have an opportunity to understand Solzhenitsyn, a Russian patriot, but also to understand his worldview, and this is the big problem we have in America today. Because, you know, Christianity has been the traditional, faith of our people. But unfortunately, because of the influence within our schools and within our universities, more and more young people are beginning to turn away from Christianity, or the Christianity they're embracing has very little to do with the faith of their fathers. We've got about 30 seconds for you to wrap up the program. What are your parting thoughts, Professor?
Well, I would simply like to say that we put together a book that, if I can focus on the book as we end, that we designed for readers who know Solzhenitsyn, but even more for readers who do not, so that with every section of material, we have an introduction written by us two co-editors to help readers get oriented so that they can understand enough background to make good sense of the reading. We can only lead the horses to water. The horses will have to drink on their own, but we're hopeful.
God bless
you.
Thank you so very much for being with us again.
And thank you, sir.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I hope that you enjoyed my interview with Professor Erickson. And, of course, he is writing from a Christian worldview and from about an author, one of the world's great authors, probably the greatest living author of our time, who is writing from a worldview, and that's why, from a Christian worldview, that's why he's been so viciously attacked, because, ladies and gentlemen, there really is a conspiracy against God. You see it in the effort to take God and prayer out of our schools and take the Ten Commandments down off of our school walls or take them out of the public buildings. You see this conspiracy against God in the effort to take the Christ out of Christmas, to take down nativity scenes, and to take crosses down. There really is an intense hatred of Christianity. When you understand that, you understand this is really being mediated by people within secret organizations like the Masons. It was the Masons who controlled the Supreme Court from 1971 to 1941, 1941 to 1971, and it was their influence. They controlled the Supreme Court in majorities of 5 to 4 to 8 to 1 during that 30-year period. And the fact that nobody will tell you that, the fact that, you know, there is no way you're going to hear this from your pulpits or from your Christian or conservative leaders, is simply a reflection of the influence of the dark side over the good people of America and ultimately the control of what the American people think. If you have not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. It's a simple read. It's nothing like Solzhenitsyn. Certainly I'm not a great author. But the facts are there. It's readable. It'll introduce you to what we're talking about. And then if you want to get into more detail, you can get Professor Quigley's 1,342-page book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. Professor Quigley taught at Harvard and Princeton before he went to Georgetown University, where he met a young man named William Jefferson Clinton and counseled Clinton and explained to him who really runs the world and introduced him to the secret society which became, here in the United States, the organization which is located at 5868 Street in New York City, known as the Council on Foreign Relations. Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, is available through Radio Liberty by itself or with a special, Tragedy and Hope special, which includes the book Foundations, Their Power and Influence, which has also been suppressed for many years, and an interview with Professor Quigley where he talks about how his book was actively suppressed. He talks about the emblem on the back of the dollar bill and these crazy right-wingers, because he thought that people like you and I, he referred to us as the petty bourgeois who voted for Barry Goldwater. He said that, you know, that we really didn't understand. He said a lot of these people tell me that that is the symbol of the Illuminati on the back of the dollar bill. He said that symbol's been there for 6,000 years. I can prove it. And Professor Quigley's absolutely right. So what is the 6,000-year-old emblem doing on the back of the dollar bill? Or maybe, just maybe, there are things that the average person doesn't understand. Well, if you go to our website, RadioLiberty.com, you read our newsletters while you begin to catch a glimpse of what's going on. Certainly our August, September, October, November newsletters available at RadioLiberty.com. Go there, get them, pull them down. You need to get our pamphlets on the occult hierarchy. There are three pamphlets, which make up about 15 or 16 of our newsletters that we've written. We'll introduce you to what's going on today. Feel free to copy our newsletters and distribute them, get them out. This is what we want. You can do that without charge. You can copy anything that we have actually produced ourselves, as long as you're not making a profit on it. We want you to get the information out. You need to get the videos. They sold their souls for rock and roll, the 3-hour, 4-hour, 10-hour, either video or V8 or a DVD. You need to get the tape set, The Wisdom of Malachi Martin, along with his book entitled Hostage to the Devil. Because there really are demonic forces in the world today. They're organized. They're moving us towards a new world order, a new world religion. They're moving us towards World War III, ladies and gentlemen. It's only really a matter of time. Please pray for America. Pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. Thank you. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And of course, our guest this evening is Bob Chapman, who's the editor of the International Forecaster. And Bob is one of the few people I know who have been at this business longer than I have. He has been writing and speaking and studying the economic system. I started back in the late 1950s, had his own stockbrokerage firm for many, many years, and his International Forecaster is certainly one of the most intriguing publications. It comes out twice a week, about 25 pages. I read it through religiously, and you will learn not only what's happening economically, but so many of the other things you're not going to hear elsewhere. Bob Chapman, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me again.
One of the things I wanted to check on you, and I wanted to see if I was right. My understanding is that the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, has actually lowered the margin requirements for the stock market from about 50% down to 10%. Is that true?
Well, I didn't see that.
All right, fine. Well, then, have they lowered the margin requirements for purchasing stocks?
They've lowered, I understand, for hedge funds.
For hedge funds?
That is not overall. It's just for those professional funds. And that was a couple of months ago. And they did that because they were able to achieve that kind of leverage in foreign markets. And the excuse for the drop in that margin rate was it will lose business if we don't do it.
Well, could you explain to our listeners
very subtly and very quietly they've done that.
Well, could you explain to our listeners what the this significance of lowering the margin requirements is? In fact, could you explain to them what margins are, why anybody would want to buy stocks on margins, and of course, what impact this is having on the stock market prices today?
Well, first of all, I was a broker for 28 years, and I never used a margin account for margin. And the reason I didn't, I felt that there was enough inherent leverage in securities that I didn't feel it was necessary. And people can lose an awful lot of money if they choose the wrong way. Margin requirements have been at 50% for many, many years. And
two shares of stock for the price of one. As long as the price goes up, you're in good shape.
Exactly. And, of course, the leverage to the downside, which is negative to you, goes the same way. And so margin requirements have been changed from time to time, but not by very much, but certainly not from 50 to 10%. And that just adds to what hedge funds are doing.
No, what are the hedge funds playing now for their margins?
Well, it varies anywhere from 10 to 50%.
In other words, the hedge funds could actually get a 10% margin, can play the market with a 10% margin?
Yeah, and, you know, the reason why is that they can go in Europe and get more loans without the same qualifications that are necessary to do those kinds of trades in New York.
Because then they can make a lot. They can make a lot of money if it goes the right direction. But what happens if it goes the wrong direction?
That's very, very nasty.
We're going to be back in just
today. They use derivatives to
hold that. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Bob Chapman. We were simply talking about the fact that they apparently have changed the margin requirements for the people who are in the hedge funds who are playing the stock market, so they can get tremendous leverage when they're buying stocks. And, of course, the hedge funds have countless millions, sometimes even billions of dollars to put into the stock market. Do you think that's one reason why the price of the stock market is going up as rapidly as it is right now?
It's certainly being aided for that, and that keeps the Fed from having to increase their exposure in the repo market, and it also tones down the amount of interference in the market that is done by the working group in financial markets via the Treasury's Exchange Stabilization Fund. And so, yeah, it's a big assist. I mean, as it is, I have an explanation going into the next issue on what the Fed does. And we don't know exactly how much the Exchange Stabilization Fund has in available cash, but I would guess it to be about $500 billion. The Fed, when they lend money, they lend it to brokerage firms to which they instruct what to do with that money. And also, when they increase money to banks, and they do that by buying government securities from them, which in fact gives them cash, they take the cash and they multiply that about 7 to 1. And so a $20 billion, and this is a ballpark figure, a $20 billion infusion into the repo market could increase the amount of money available on one day to $200 billion in addition to what they've already got in the market. So between the two of them, they're probably swinging $200 to $300 billion a day in the market. Never mind what the hedge funds are allowed to do by their borrowing. The leverage is beyond belief. Now, what they've done today is they have used insurance, which is called derivatives, and that's the way they eliminate a part of the downside, and that's why.
Now, Bob, hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with the stations. Well, yeah, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Bob Chapman. He's simply talking about what's going on in the market. And, of course, the hedge funds are coming in, and they're buying stocks on margins, and then they're hedging their bets so that in case the stock turns against them, they have a derivative that's going to cover them. The only trouble is that if this were to happen on a very large scale, the derivatives, there are lots more derivatives out there than there are dollars in there, or finances in the whole entire world, something like, $370 trillion in derivatives, all written to guarantee that nobody loses in the system. But what's wrong with that? Isn't the derivative a great way to ensure that you won't have a loss?
That's correct, but if one of the writers of derivatives gets into trouble for some reason, because they're based on probability, and if something goes haywire and there's a tremendous increase or decrease in markets, then one of the majors can get caught outside, and they do business with other major derivative writers, and incidentally that market is totally unregulated, as is the hedge fund market, then you could have a cascading interconnected collapse in all markets as it spread from one market to another. And this is the great fear that something like that would happen. And I think it's going to happen sooner or later. And the number is close to going over 400 trillion now. And I can remember when I wrote about derivatives first in 1993, that's now 13 years ago, and I told people that the market was you know, approximately $1 trillion, $2 trillion. They thought I was crazy. I would get phone calls from stockbrokers saying that these figures just can't be right. And I said, well, they are right. And so I was one of the first ones to expose what they were doing. And one of the reasons there's no regulation is that these banks and insurance companies and brokerage firms and investment banks that write these derivatives, they do this because there is a tremendous amount of stock trading going on, and you might have a fund that, say, it's got $5 billion, and they may make the equivalent of $8 billion worth of stock trades during the course of a period, and they may end up with $6 billion, having made $1 billion, but the exposure and the cost is enormous. And, of course, the brokerage firms that are doing those transactions, they're making a fortune. And you've seen talk this past week of the tremendous amount of, you'd call it bonuses, that are being given up by Wall Street, historic in nature. And that's how this is happening. There are a few firms like Citigroup and Goldman Sachs, Deutsche Bank, and J.P. Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, all of whom are doing business with the United States government, and they are making money through trading because they are helping the United States government rig the market.
But as far as the derivatives are concerned, why, if right now they were $1 to $2 trillion back in '93, today they're over, well, pushing, as you say, $400 trillion. Is that right?
There's no end to it.
And of course, if this thing,
I mean, just to give you an example, there's $756 billion in U.S. dollar-denominated notes. Ones, fives, tens, twenties, fifties, and $100 bills. So that'll give you a perspective on that number. I don't happen to know what the GDP is, but I know it's less than that.
GDP's
the
about,
whole thing
about
is colossally
trillion.
Mad.
Right, the GDP is about $12 trillion, is what they say.
Well, there you go. You got a $400 trillion market, and the GDP's $12 trillion. Doesn't that tell somebody that this really shouldn't be going on?
Well, I think that Warren Buffett said it best. He said these are financial weapons of mass destruction, currently latent but potentially lethal.
And Warren Buffett is one of them.
Right. And he may very well be, but he's a very, very smart cookie. I mean, I believe he's absolutely right. He plays with the derivative market, but he also realizes that he's playing with dynamite. Well, anyway, of course, as we see the market going up, I mean, you comment in your latest newsletter that certainly, you know, when we've seen this margin requirements and the impact of margins in the past, this happens just before the great dropout. What was it, in 2000? 1999, 2000?
It happened in the second and third week of March of 2000. And the reason I know it so distinctly is that the international forecaster told everybody in the first week of April to hightail out of the market, and Joe Granville did the same thing the same day I did, and we were two of less than 1.5% of all newsletter writers, analysts, economists in the world who got people out of the market.
And, of course, this was based upon the fact that there was a significant margin requirement. In other words, an awful lot of people were buying stocks on margins at that time. Is that correct?
It is, and that figure is higher today than it was then.
And I think that's what's so
important. Not counting the hedge funds.
Right. Well, as far as you're concerned right now, what do you think people should be doing?
Well, first of all, I think they should be exiting the stock market. I want to quote you a piece I just wrote for Saturday, if I still got it here. And no, I don't. It's gone up for typing. But the IMF said, you better watch out. We're going to have problems.
When did they make that statement?
Today.
Okay.
And I chopped it down from two pages to one paragraph, you know, just getting the important points. But the IMF is one of the internationalist organizations, and for them to come out and say that, I think they're downright terrified of what they see, and rightly they should be. Of course, they say that in their pronouncement, and that is, don't be so copacetic. Don't be so laid back about what's going on, because there's some terrible dangers out there, and that the economy probably will slow down next year. Well, I know darn right well it's going to slow down, because it already has. We've been in the beginnings of a recession for the last 11 months, and it'll become patently obvious during the first 6 months of this coming year. In fact, I just finished before the program writing a piece, and I'm looking for growth in manufacturing of 2.5%, down from 4.5% this year, and I'm looking for the overall economy to grow at the rate of 1.5% to 2%. And anything under 2% is a recession. And if we don't have an event, that will go on for a couple of years. Now, we will have an event, and that will be caused by the dollar falling in value. And once the dollar breaks support, all havoc is going to let loose. And as you've seen recently, a number of countries have said that they are going to diversify their dollar holdings. We get Venezuela, Indonesia, the United Arab Emirates. And we know for a fact that Russia and China have been lightening up.
You mean they're getting out of the dollar?
Yes. The Gulf oil producers have reduced their exposure over the past year from 67 to 65% of their foreign reserves. And, of course, Iran said the other day, well, the United States has forced banks all over the world to refuse to do dollar transactions with us, so we can't do business, so we are not going to hold dollars anymore. What we're going to do is use the euro. Now, they have threatened before to have a bourse for oil, designating buying and selling in the bourse, in euros rather than dollars. This is one of the main reasons that the United States invaded Iraq. Saddam Hussein was buying and selling oil in euros. They had to stop him from doing that. The reason why is the dollar oil configuration, the sale of oil in dollars, is what keeps the dollar as a world reserve currency. And the minute that stops, the game's over.
But of course, we're
they're not going to do anything in any currency other than the euro, because their major markets are there. And so the United States has two choices. They either negotiate a deal with Iran, or they have Israel nuke them.
But of course, we're really forcing Iran to switch to the euro. And of course, when Iran switches to the euro, Venezuela will switch to the euro. And if any of the Arab countries start, you know, selling in their oil in euros rather than dollars, won't this have a tremendous impact on the reserve status of the American currency?
Well, I expect it will drop 40 to 50%.
How long a time do you think it'll take?
2.5-3 years.
Okay, fine. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Bob Chapman. And listen to what he has to say. I think we're in a very, very real problem economically. The average individual has no idea what lies out there. And they're not going to listen to you if you tell them. But at least a few people will begin to make preparations. Well, Bob, go ahead, pick the story up there. And I noticed you had something in your latest newsletter about the Economist All Items Index, and it was simply talking really about what's happening to our prices, and they claim that, you know, certainly our prices are going up, you know, astronomically, 30% or more, and yet the government here says the items are only going up 2 or 3%.
Well, that's true, and it surprised me that The Economist, which is an elitist publication, it's controlled by the Illuminati, would come out with that. And I think the reason that they did is that it's become so obvious that the United States is lying, and they're not the only ones. The United Kingdom, Japan, and some of the other European countries are lying about their statistics. And it's gotten so bad in the United States that nobody believes anything. Nobody within the professional community believes anything that the government has to say anymore. And I have contended over the last 4 years that inflation has been over 10%. And as a rule of thumb, all you have to do is take the increase in M3, which is no longer published, but I and three other sources are publishing an estimate, and we're pretty close. And you've seen that in the International Forecaster.
And all you
have to do with that is come up with the true figure, which is close to 12% right now, and deduct the increases in productivity, which are 2 to 2.5%, and you're down to 11 to 10.5% increase in the amount of money and credit being created by the Federal Reserve.
And that would be reflected in inflation rate then, is that right?
Well, that's what inflation really is.
Right.
And it's as simple as that to do it. Another rule of thumb is you take the money supply, which is M2, and you multiply it by 1.5. So right now it's 4.7%. So that's 9.4, and we'll say 2.4, which is 11.9, which is right on my figures. Now there's one other aspect to that increase in credit outstanding. Credit is being created by derivatives and other ways of creating credit. And when you add them in, you're looking at 14%. Now, the increase, we'll just take the increase by the Fed, and let us call it 11% to be conservative. The countries in Europe right now are averaging 11%. They're doing the same thing that Washington's doing. And so we have this tremendous increase in money and credit, which is, in fact, devaluing the value of all the currencies that are doing that. And that's why about a year and a half ago, that gold, in terms of all currencies, broke out and broke away from all currencies, including the perennial strong currency of the world, the Swiss franc.
Hold that.
And that means,
back in just a moment here, our guest is Bob Chapman. And Bob is just saying that because of the massive increase in the amount of liquidity by not only the United States, but all countries in the world, here just a year or so ago, why gold began to break loose and began to really zoom up and increase dramatically in cost and value. But it really didn't increase in value. It was just that all the other currencies were losing their value. Would that be a fair statement, Bob?
Yes, and that means that all currencies, to an extent, are fiat. So if the dollar goes down 50% against the six major currencies in the world, which I believe it will, in the near future, over the next 2.5 years, then that means that gold in terms of other currencies will go up in value, but it'll go up in value at least 50% versus the dollar. Now, that doesn't include the inflation that's backed up. So you're probably looking at a price of something in the area of $1,700 to $2,000 for an ounce of gold to offset that. And then when that's taking place and the dollar's falling, all the stock markets of the world are going down. In order to arrest that, they raise their interest rates, which you saw in 1980. And that exacerbates the problem vis-a-vis gold and all currencies. And then everybody takes a flight to quality, which is gold, and that makes gold go berserk. And you could be looking at $4,000 or $5,000 or $6,000 gold. And that's what's going to happen.
And you figure this is what, over the next 3 to 5 years, or will it be sooner than that?
It's always hard to be that firm on a time span. But anywhere between 2 and 5, and probably 2 to 2.5. There'll be more money made in gold and silver related assets in the next 3 years than has been made in any market in the history of mankind.
Well, now what about silver?
And there will be more money lost in the next few years than ever in history.
Well, we were just talking a few minutes ago to a professor who is has written extensively about Solzhenitsyn, and Solzhenitsyn's written about what happened in Russia in 1991, 1992, 1993, when the value of the currency was completely destroyed. And all of the people there were impoverished, and their pensions were gone, and suddenly, you know, they suddenly no longer have communism. But they no longer have any material stability either. People don't think that could happen here.
Well, I think what's going to happen in America and throughout the world, because we're the doggy and the rest is the tail, and when we wiggle our tail, it's like a magic wand. The economy of the world has a problem. And we are going to have a depression in America. One-third of the people will be unemployed. One-third of the people are going to lose their homes. There's going to be thousands, millions of people on the streets wandering around looking for food to feed their children. There'll be warring gangs, and eventually it'll turn into a total revolution. And I see no other way. And it's going to happen in probably every country. And it's not going to be very nice, but this is what these elitists have deliberately caused in order to implement world government, and they're going to be wrong again, like they've been wrong so many times before over the last 1,000 years. And, of course, mankind's going to pay for it. I mean, look at the 30 years war. Two-thirds of the people in Germany died. So if you out there listening think that 150 or 120 million Americans can't die, get real. They can. And the situation in other countries could be as bad, if not worse.
Well, I fear that there are people in Washington, D.C. are anticipating civil unrest in this country, and that's why they've refurbished all those Japanese concentration camps that are out in the middle of nowhere, but they just appropriated $38 million to actually spruce up and rebuild and modernize those Japanese concentration camps, 10 of them, where they put 120,000 Japanese in 1942 and 1943. During the Second World War, loyal Japanese said that they put them there. What we want to refurbish those now, because we don't want anybody to ever forget, really, how terrible it is putting Americans in concentration camps. Then we're going to give Halliburton $385 million to build new detention camps. If you doubt that, go up on the Internet. Check it out. It's really true. I wonder why. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Bob Chapman. And Bob, certainly painting a very, very bleak picture, but I think somebody has to say it can happen here in America. And you go back and you see what happened in Russia in the early 1990s, we talked about in the last hour. The Russian people lost all, 99% of the value of their currency. Recently, they revalued the Turkish, whatever it is, the dollar or lira, whatever it is. They just took six zeros off, and you had a millionaire, and now you have one lira. People don't understand that sort of thing. We've always had at least somewhat of a stable currency here, but why don't we pick the story out there, Bob? Certainly what you're suggesting is really serious problems with our currency, which means serious problems with the stability of our society.
Well, this has been going on since the 1960s, and it started with free trade and globalization as long ago as that. GATT, then the separation from the gold standard in 1971, the imposition of WTO in 1986, 1994-5, we saw NAFTA created, and all of these things, as a starter, have taken over 8 million jobs out of America during that time span, but 5 million have been lost just in the last 7 or 8 years. And that's a tremendous loss, and those are $31.50 an hour jobs.
We said it,
and,
just
you know, they've been replaced by $12 an hour jobs.
And, of course, they're not jobs in manufacturing. We're really shipping our manufacturing jobs. Do you have any idea how many manufacturing jobs we have now, Bob?
No, I don't. I have the figure right at my fingertips. But I know we're down. I see different figures from different economists. And it ranges anywhere between 9% and 13%. And it's not very much.
We've lost.
And that's why if we have a 50% fall in the dollar, and I do have a baseline for this, 1985-86, the dollar fell 62%. And most people conveniently don't want to remember that. And it did absolutely nothing to improve our balance of trade deficit or our balance of payments deficit.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Bob Chapman was just saying that our value of our currency back in the mid-1980s fell about 60%, but it didn't do anything to affect our balance, our trade deficit. This is the whole idea. Won't it be wonderful when the value of our currency falls, then our goods become more competitive, competing in the world market. The trouble is, we don't have that many goods that are competing in the world market because we've shipped so much of our manufacturing out of this country. And we're not producing as we used to. At one time, almost half of the world's production came out of the United States right after the Second World War. And now, of course, the Chinese communists have over 100 million manufacturing jobs, and the last figure I saw was between 14 and 17 million manufacturing jobs in the entire United States, and losing every single day. We'll pick the story up there, Bob.
I think that what we have to look at here is the extension of losses of jobs. We're not talking about engineering, architecture, in the medical fields, radiology, and also the exporting now of the treatment and medical care to foreign facilities, because in many instances the quality is as good, if not better, than in the United States for one quarter to one half the price.
Well, you know, what they're doing, Bob, is they're actually shipping CTs and MRIs, electronic, over to India, and they'll get them read immediately and get the results back here within a few minutes. And they're even sending x-rays to other countries to be read because they don't have to hire a radiologist at $75,000 to $100,000 a year. You can get somebody to work over there for $20,000 a year. They're grateful for it. so much of our medical treatment is being shipped overseas. I was talking to an ophthalmologist the other day where they have a special camera. They take pictures of the back of the eye looking for macular degeneration or other changes. And those are not red in San Francisco as they traditionally have been. They're now red in India. And, of course, they get the results back the same day. Isn't technology wonderful? But what's it going to do for the salaries of the people who in the past have read these CTs and the MRIs and the X-rays and the eye scans?
Well, the public doesn't get it. You know, they see the cheap goods in the shelves. They see the benefits of things that are cheaper. They don't realize in order to get that advantage in buying, well, they're still employed. Somebody is losing their job. And we can't continue to that because it's ripping the heart out of our country. And it just goes on and on and nobody gets it. I don't know what happened to the brain power of the labor unions, but they should be all up in their hind legs screaming, the rank and file, we don't have any more. I mean, they're all working at as green as at Walmart or flipping hamburgers at McDonald's. You can't make your home, your house payments, and pay your bills on $12 or even $15 an hour, unless you want to live in some kind of a hovel. And that's what we're faced with. And it has to stop. And you want the answer? It is very simple. All we have to do is impose trade tariffs on every nation in the world, and then figure out how much they're screwing us for on any given item or service, and we increase the price of it by a tariff. And what's good about that is all that tariff money flows into the U.S. Treasury, and our taxes drop as well. And that's why we had tariffs since the very beginning of our country, and it helped make our country great.
Well,
we have the biggest market in the world, and if we continue to do what we're doing for another 2 years, I can promise all you listeners that you will not have a country left. You will have a wild zoo going on.
Well, I think, Bob, of course, the thing is that the people who control the political power in the United States, the globalists, really don't want to have a country here. That's why they're doing what they're doing. They know it's going to destroy our jobs. They know it's going to destroy our economy. They know it's going to destroy the middle class and impoverish our people. And that's exactly what they want. That's what it says in the Earth Charter, which they subscribe to. They have a different worldview. They want a different type of America than the average American.
Well, you're right, Stan. And they also have that planned for any other prosperous nation. Now, that means all of Western Europe and Canada and Japan. Now, China will go down because their banking system is a mess. I'll leave it at that. They're behind the eight ball for over $1 trillion in bad debt. The same kind of position Japan was in 1992, and they still have not come out of depression. And so that's where we're all headed. And yes, it is deliberate. And they, the elitists, think that they're going to be able to implement world government, and that's not going to happen.
Maybe you can answer something for me, Bob, because this really intrigued me. We find that Goldman Sachs is going over there and buying up, you know, large segments of some of these banks over in China that have these massive non-performing loans. We find the same thing with J.P. Morgan Chase and Citibank. They're going over putting billions of dollars into these Chinese banks, which have got to be an extension of the corrupt government over there. And certainly if our economy turns down, why, the Chinese economy is going to be go ahead and go right into the tank because they're dependent upon our consumption for their financial stability. I could see why, you know, many of our industrialists would go over there to put their plants in because they're guaranteed that, you know, if anything happens that they'll be compensated by our government if they lose their plants. But why would our banks be doing what they're doing? Don't they realize, of course, they could stand to lose countless billions of dollars by investing in these faulty banks, which in Japan, in China today are just like the Japanese banks? You know, where at one time the 8 of the 10 largest banks in the world were Japanese. And before long, where they were, their stocks were penny stocks, and those Japanese banks have still not gotten out of the hole they were in. Why are our banks doing it?
Because they have an endless supply of money, that's why. The Federal Reserve being a private organization, those banks, some of them are owners of the Federal Reserve, and all they have to do is call the Federal Reserve and say, we need some more money, and they say, how much? You know, $83 billion. Yeah, okay, we're going to debit this and credit you $83 billion. And that's the way it works.
Well,
it's as simple as that. They just keep on creating money. That's why you cannot be long. You cannot own anything in dollars. The exception being gold and silver in a hyperinflationary, inflationary environment. The only possible thing to be in a currency is the Swiss franc. And that's it. There isn't anything else. And it's as simple as that.
Well,
there's nothing esoteric about this.
What about silver?
I mean, I've done all the esoteric work with along with a handful of maybe 100 people in the world who know what's going on deeply financially, and the rest of the world had better listen. Because if they don't listen, they're not going to have anything.
Well, what about silver? You know, certainly we've been hearing, I can remember back in the 60s when they were talking about, you know, certainly when we demonetized silver, but the price of silver was going to go up, and we've been waiting, well, I've been waiting for 40 years for the price of silver to go up. And it has gone up, certainly, but it hasn't even kept up with inflation, really, over this period of time. So what do you see happening to silver today?
Well, first of all, silver and gold both are not reflecting their true value because they're being manipulated by the United States government. The government is our enemy. There's just no two ways about it, at least from a financial viewpoint. And now that we have corporatist fascism, from a governmental viewpoint as far as our social life is concerned. And anybody who has studied history can easily see that. And so they're going to continue to do what they want to do as long as they can. They think they're going to get away with it. But with communications the way they are today, the minute the people realize we have a recession, which will be next year, and these massive layoffs begin, they'll also find that they've been lied to about the unemployment problem, which is currently over 13%. And that's going to grow to 35%. When you have 35% of the public unemployed, you've got some nasty problems on your hands, especially in a country like the United States with its 450 million weapons.
Well, certainly, if you're going to have civil unrest, you certainly don't want to give up your weapons. I mean, you want something to be able to protect yourself because there aren't enough police to protect you.
That's right. And, you know, the way the government is today, they paramilitarized the police. And if the police are forced to work with the government against the people, unfortunately, along with whoever else acts in behalf of the United States government, they'll be liquidated by the public. And the public can, whether they like it or not, afford to lose half the population of the United States. And this is what these people don't understand. Because when somebody has no alternative, they go for broke. And if your children are starving, if you have no place to live, you can't go anywhere, you can't work, you don't even know where your next meal's coming from, desperate people do desperate things. And they will reach a stage where they will attack the government. And that's one of the reasons why our government does not want a draft. That's why they want to hire and train foreign mercenaries now, if you've seen. And that's why they have a 30,000 force over in Iraq and Afghanistan of U.S. mercenaries. And they're hired from mercenary companies. 30,000 among 300 million people is a drop in the bucket. even a full force of 3 million armed American military against 150 million adults, they don't stand a chance. Even if the public got sticks and stones, they don't get it. They're all going to die. Because this time, they're not going to get away with it.
Well, I think that we're entering into a very, very difficult time, Bob, and I'm sure you would share my opinion on that. Economically, first, we are a bankrupt nation. We're having to borrow money on a daily basis from other nations continue going. Now, my understanding, Bob, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that it's taking about $3.5 billion a day that's having to be borrowed, but only about a billion of that is coming from other countries, and about a billion of it's coming from Americans lending to our government, and then another billion and a half are actually being just sort of created out of nothing. Where's that $3.5 billion coming from that we're borrowing every day?
Well, as of late, over the last year, it's come from people who have dollars outside the country who are buying Treasury and agency debt from the United States government, and they're also investing in companies and in the stock and bond markets of the United States. When there's a shortfall, what the Fed does is they create money and monetize it in order to balance it, but they can't do that forever because in doing so, it's immediately highly inflationary. And they have been doing it, and they will continue to do it, but they only want to do it as much as they have to do it. And so between the foreigners, usually central banks, between the public, which is American financial institutions of one form or another, and between the Fed, they've been able to keep it afloat. But in that process, they have caused more than 10% annually inflation. And they can't keep on doing that indefinitely. And that's why it's so important that they manipulate and suppress the price of gold and silver so people will not realize. They will say to themselves, gee, gold and silver is not going up, so consequently there's probably not a problem.
Well, I want you to, Chris, get your address out there so people will know how to get in touch with the International Forecaster and perhaps get a free copy, and then perhaps they'll want to subscribe.
Well, the Forecaster is published on Wednesday and Saturday. It's two issues a week via email, and we have a hard copy that goes out twice a month, and it's about business, finance, economics, and social and political issues all over the world. And if you'd like to get a free introductory copy, all you have to do is call toll-free 800-375-4188. 800-375-4188. If you'd like to visit our site, that address is theinternationalforecaster.com. The International FORECASTER.com.
All right, fine. It's fascinating. It comes out twice a week. It's about 25 pages into Bob?
Approximately.
25 pages. And I really like it coming out twice a week rather than once a week when I have to read 50 pages. So it's a lot easier to read the 25 pages. Fascinating overview, not simply on finances, but really on everything that's going on today. So basically, certainly gold was up just a little bit today. I don't know where it closed, but it looks like it's beginning to begin to move. Certainly, I always like to see what's happening in Dubai. And it's always about $10 higher in Dubai than it is in the United States.
Well, gold had a very good week, and I predicted that it would, based upon the fact that the commercials on the COMEX and the big hitters on the TOCOM in Tokyo had been liquidating their short positions. They had liquidated about 60% of their shorts, and that's very bullish for gold and silver. Now, silver has been lagging, and the only reason it went down during the period prior to and through the month of November and into December is that a large amount of gold was leased by somebody, one of the central banks. We don't know the exact amount, but it was large. And it was enough to suppress the market during that period of time. And the suppression is over. And I think from here on up for the next 3 months, we're going to see much higher prices. And I think we're going to finally see the stock market headed either sideways or down. If you remember, Abby Hoffman, strategist for Goldman Sachs, said that the market would go to 12,500. And she said that 6 years ago. She's a little off on her timing, but we're there now, and I think that's where they wanted to take it. And I think it's going down from here.
All right, fine. Well, our guest, of course, has been Bob Chapman. I hope that you've enjoyed our conversations here, and Bob will be coming back again here in a couple of weeks. It's always a pleasure to keep abreast of what's going on, and certainly a fantastic amount of information about what's really going on behind the scenes economically. Information you need to know if you don't want to end up like the people of Russia in the early 1990s with no concept what lie ahead. Well, right now we've got Chris Tom calling from Ohio, who's been waiting patiently. Tom, did you have a quick question for our guest?
Yes. I was wondering, did Danny Bush take a hit on the derivatives or something, he did with Goldman Sachs?
Well, I hear rumors that the vast amounts of money were lost by the Bush crime family just recently. I can't verify that. It's in connection with the $4.5 trillion that Leo Wonta contends are owed to the United States government by the bankers. And that has not come to fore. It hasn't become a major well-known issue as yet, and that's because it's being suppressed by the people who essentially have stolen the money.
How will
central banks?
How will they retaliate, or how should I put it? How will they get their money back? Will they steal more from us?
Well, I think they just want to keep what they've got, and they want it to go away. And I think that they may be able to suppress this from the American public and avoid the noose of being caught. But if we have a financial fiasco during the next year, it's going to come out. The decent American mind of the average person can't conceive how evil and diabolical these people are. And that's why they don't get caught. They just keep on lying, and because they're in positions of power, people tend to believe them, and they own the media, except for us fellows. So they get away with these things, and they have been getting away with it for a long time.
Bob, when they clean the stores out, if this does go to the bad side, the stores aren't going to restock, and they'll clean them out in 15 minutes, and then when the food all runs up and everything burns around, they're going to bring the mercenaries in and mop it up, right?
Well, they're going to attempt that, and that's our cue to mop them up.
Okay, fine. Well, thanks very much, Tom, and thank you very much, Bob. We're just about out of time, and I really appreciate so much your being with us, and of course, giving us your view of what's happening, and I certainly think that everybody should start making preparations for difficult times. Here in California, the governor's wife, Maria Shriver, keeps telling people to prepare for an emergency. I see her almost every evening on the 11 o'clock news saying, make your preparations, make your preparations. Be prepared to look after yourself for 3 days. 3 days? She's awfully optimistic. But I wonder what she knows that the rest of us don't know. Good night, Bob. God bless.
Same to you. Bye-bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening has been Bob Chapman, and I hope you've intrigued by what he had to say. We have a great talk, even if I do say so, called The Financial Tsunami. You can get it on DVD or VHS, and then you can get a syllabus that goes with that, Financial Tsunami. If you want to understand the war in Iraq and what not only that, but all of the other wars in the last century were, the story is Iraq, the Untold Story, available in VHS. There's a syllabus that goes with it. If you'd like to understand sustainable development, there's a video. There's a and a syllabus goes with it. We have information on so many things. You want to understand water fluoridation and how they're poisoning you and your family. The hidden agenda. It's the story of water fluoridation, and that is the syllabus that goes with that. Now, we have a couple of DVDs on this. Is Your Drinking Water Safe? And Let the Truth Be Told. Excellent DVDs on water fluoridation. They're poisoning our children, and they're poisoning us with mercury. And, of course, you want to get the smoking truth, or the smoking truth, I should say. One DVD, a second DVD, is entitled Thimerosal. We have a VHS on the thimerosal and the vaccines they're using to poison our children and bring about Alzheimer's disease in the elderly. That's Dr. Ayoub's DVD. And you can see, at least the last one, up on the Internet, free of charge. Of course, we hope that you want to get a copy of the VHS from us and distribute it. We have four tape sets on water fluoridation. We have four tape sets on autism and on mercury. We have a wonderful book on fluoride. It's called The Fluoride Deception. We have a great book on mercury called Evidence of Harm. Understand what they're doing. If you don't understand that they put a cancer virus in the original polio vaccine, you need, of course, to get the book The Virus and the Vaccine. The Virus and the Vaccine. And then you go up to my website and look up my newsletters on vaccination, and you'll learn the story of how they punished the woman who saved millions of lives by identifying the virus that was in the original polio vaccine. Why did they punish her? Why, because, of course, she saved millions of lives. Her name was Dr. Bernice Eddy. This story is told in a book actually published under the auspices of the National Institute of Health, called The Health Century by Dr. Edward Shorter, but we've summarized it in my newsletters. If you go to our website at radioliberty.com, you can pull them down. Radioliberty.com, just go to the newsletters and go back about, I think it was in 2002 or 2003, my two letters on vaccination. Get them, read them, copy them, distribute them. Help us get the truth out. They're poisoning our children. The vaccinations, it's not simply the fact that usually they don't work, but they put adjuvants in them. They put aluminum. They put mercury in. Certainly they tell you, we've taken out of childhood vaccines. Yes, in some ways that's true, but they put it in vaccinations we give to children, because influenza is not a childhood vaccine, although it's a vaccine we give to children. You see, it's a play on words. And they're advocating a mercury-laden vaccine for a six-month-old child that can do nothing but harm. They're advocating a mercury-laden influenza vaccine for women in the first trimester of their pregnancy, when it will do the maximum harm to the child in her womb. Why would you do that? Why? Because mercury not only destroys the brain, it destroys the fertility, and at least this is what the animal studies show. That's why you need to get Dr. Ayoub's excellent video. You just call us at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Dr. Ayoub's VHS on the vaccines, and of course it's on the mercury in the vaccines. The DVDs, the smoking truth, or the thimerosal on water fluoridation. Let the truth be told. And is your drinking water safe? Our four tape sets. Get the information, ladies and gentlemen. Find out that they're poisoning our people. They know exactly what they're doing. If you have not yet got my material on population control, or my talk on planned population reduction, 1-800-544-8927.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network.